Today, the southern half of the UK will see some thicker clouds and a little bit of rain. The southeast of England starts Saturday a little bit damp, but it should dry up, brighten up and warm up through the weekend.
A little last blast of summer. Lovely. Thanks, Jay. Jay Wynne there at the BBC Weather Centre. Our book of the week, a cautionary tale of poison, betrayal and greed. And the coroner's inquest continues its inquiries into the suspected poisoning of George Bodle at Plumstead in 1833. Julian Reintart reads from The Inheritor's Powder by Sandra Hempel.
At last, Coroner Carter called the star turn, the charming, lazy young John, dressed in the latest fashions. Mr. Colquhoun began by asking him to explain the early morning visits to his grandfather's farm, which had begun so suspiciously just 2 weeks before his grandfather's death. The story that emerged was one of innocent flirtation between two young people, starting with young John asking for some cream with the milk, and Sophia, the maid, sending a message that he could have some if he came himself. On the crucial day, he had got up early, and had set off to fetch the milk. He found Sophia cleaning the stove, so he took the kettle to the pump and refilled it for her. Asked whether he could account for the arsenic that Constable Morris had found in his trunk, he said yes. He used it to treat the itch. He put 1/2 ounce in a bottle, mixed it with 6 ounces of water, and applied it to his skin rash with a piece of rag. He had been using arsenic in this way off and on for 4 years. He had bought the poison from Mr. Evans, the druggist, for that purpose. The itch was scabies, shameful because of its unsightliness and its association with dirty living conditions. Young John's care over his skin was characteristic of a man who wore fashionable clothes in the depths of rural Kent. Women, of course, had been using arsenic as a cosmetic for centuries, either topically as a paste or swallowing it in subtoxic doses. And by the 19th century, doctors were prescribing it for practically everything from asthma to typhus, malaria, period pain, worms, anemia, syphilis, neuralgia, and as a general pick-me-up. The favourite mixture was a proprietary brand developed by a Staffordshire doctor called Fowler to treat what was known as ague, fevers and chills, usually related to malaria. A 1% solution of potassium arsenite, Fowler's, was still being prescribed in the 1930s. The coroner, Charles Carter, wanted to hear from the doctors about the dangers of using arsenic on the skin. Presumably, he was wondering whether young John's account of the amount of arsenic he got through was believable. Doctors John Butler and Francis Bossy said that a cold arsenic solution would certainly dry up itchy pimples. They believed that his mixture of 6 ounces of water and 1/2 ounce of arsenic was dangerous, but couldn't say if it would have made him ill. With the evidence now in, the coroner began to sum up. George Bodle's death was caused by a small quantity of arsenic, and it was evident that the poison had been in the family's coffee. Carter then sent the jury out, reminding them that if they went against the prisoner, he would be sent for trial. The jury trooped back after only 1/2 hour. The verdict of the jury is that John Bodle, the younger, the prisoner, is guilty of willful murder against George Bodle, announced the foreman. Carter told young John, "It falls to my lot to announce to you the verdict is willful murder against you. It will be my duty, therefore, to commit you to Maidstone Jail for trial." The young man showed no reaction, just shook hands with some of his friends before being led out. Young John spent the night locked up in Plumstead Cage, the little prison cell next to the poorhouse on the main road, watched over by 2 constables. The next morning, his mother, sister, and other female members of the family came to say goodbye. This was also the day of George Bodle's funeral at St. Nicholas Church. As the funeral procession made its dignified journey to the ceremony, there passed by on the other side of the road a large locked van, the horses pulling it, clipping along at a somewhat smarter pace than the hearse. Young John was on his way to Maidstone Jail. As November gave way to December in West Kent, the mild weather continued. The local paper was reporting unseasonal phenomena such as gooseberry bushes and pear trees coming into fruit, white violets starring the banks of the roads, and summer flies swarming over the fields. The 1833 Kent Winter Assizes opened for business at Maidstone on Tuesday the 10th of December before Sir Stephen Gaisley, Justice of His Majesty's Court of Common Pleas, and Sir John Vaughan, Baron of His Majesty's Court of Exchequer. The grand jury, whose job was to decide whether the accused had a case to answer, was presided over by Lord Brecknock and made up of local worthies. The petty jury, tasked with hearing the cases the grand jury put before them, included chemists, carpenters, farmers, butchers, grocers, a cordwainer, an auctioneer, and a smattering of gentlemen. Inauspiciously, young John's case was listed for Friday the 13th. As the courthouse doors swung open, the crowds, some of whom had been waiting for hours in the dark to secure a good place, rushed into the building, and the galleries and benches were packed with those who were, in the words of the Times, exhibiting a most intense desire to catch every word of the evidence. Many of them were well-dressed women. Young John was brought from his cell across the prison yard and into the courthouse. He had abandoned the fashionable clothes he'd worn at the inquest and was now dressed very genteelly, one reporter thought, in deep mourning. In court, young John was described as being of no occupation rather than as gentleman, and the clerk of the arraigns read the indictment. The charge was that young John had conveyed a large quantity of white arsenic into the kitchen of George Bodle and had mixed it with water in a kettle with which George Bodle had later made coffee. John Bodle the younger pleaded not guilty. A huge number of witnesses had been lined up, 26 for the prosecution and 25 for the defence. Dr. John Butler and the chemist James Marsh testified that the post-mortem had revealed recent mischief in the stomach. Then Sophia Taylor, George Bodle's maid, was called. She denied that young John had ever filled the kettle before the day the family fell ill. She told his lawyer, Mr. Clarkson, "He's a very nice young man, and I know nothing against him." Mary Higgins, Middle John's servant, who was still living in the poorhouse where the Woolwich magistrates had sent her more than a month before, said again that she had overheard young John saying he had murdered his grandfather. It was now that the defence seems to have decided to try and pin the poisoning on Middle John rather than his son. Counsel for the defence, Mr. Clarkson, attacked Middle John, throwing around a rag bag of gossip and innuendo about his character. "It is well known, my lord," he said, "that John Bodle the elder was the first man who went before the magistrates and laid information against his son." The case was finally adjourned at 9 o'clock that night, and when the proceedings resumed at 8:30 the next morning, the courtroom was packed once again. The judge told the man at the bar that it was time for him to answer the charges. Young John stated, "I am perfectly innocent, and my defence is embodied in this paper," and handed a document to a court official. The court then sat in stillness as the unemotional voice of a clerk read what appeared to be the impassioned words of a young man pleading for his life. The statement was, in fact, a beautifully crafted piece of work by one of his legal team, William Bodkin. The evidence of the inquest about helping regularly with chores at the farmhouse and using arsenic to treat the itch was repeated. As for Mary Higgins' claim to have overheard him planning to kill his grandfather, "Gentlemen, I solemnly declare that no expression of the kind ever passed my lips. No such thought ever entered into my imagination. This part of the case rests entirely upon the evidence of my unnatural father and of his servant Mary Higgins. You will recollect that my own father is the first to accuse me of this dreadful crime. He it is who puts this charge in motion against me. The defence then produced character witnesses, each vying to see who could heap the most praise on young John. Mr. Justice Gaisley began his summing up. Hardly had he drawn breath, though, when he was interrupted by the foreman. The jury could save his lordship the trouble of reading any further. They had already heard enough to come to a verdict. My lord, we are quite satisfied, and our verdict will not be against the prisoner. The prisoner looked bewildered, and seemed not to take in the verdict till his friends rushed to the dock to clap him on the back, and he was greeted by cheering crowds in the streets. The close of this trial presented one of the most extraordinary scenes ever witnessed in a court of justice, commented the Essex Standard. A youth, accused of the murder of his grandfather, charges his own father with the crime, and is acquitted. No one could have been in the slightest doubt that George Bodle had been deliberately poisoned, but the verdict at Maidstone left the authorities at a loss as to how to proceed. The Spectator thought that the matter should not rest there. Someone ought to be prosecuted for something, in particular Middle John. We noticed at the time the suspicious circumstances that pointed at him, the magazine remarked. Here is a man, suffered to go at large, who, if the allegation made against him at the trial be true, is a criminal the atrocity of whose guilt is rarely to be paralleled. In the meantime, the chemist James Marsh's experience in the witness box had sent him back to the lab, pondering a new challenge to find a definitive way of detecting the smallest speck of arsenic and separating it from the material containing it. In the autumn of 1836, his paper appeared in the Edinburgh New Philosophical Journal under the title Account of a Method of Separating Small Quantities of Arsenic from Substances with Which It May Be Mixed. Marsh's method worked on the basis that when a solution of arsenic in any of its forms comes into contact with hydrogen, it reacts to form the gas arsine. So, hydrogen is introduced into the sample, and the metallic arsenic is then recovered from the evolving arsine. I had the satisfaction, he said, of finding that I was able to separate very minute quantities of arsenic from gruel, soup, porter, coffee, and other alimentary liquors. The unveiling of Marsh's test was a eureka moment, and hailed as such by the scientific community. Now scientists could detect with absolute certainty the smallest amount of poison. The benefit that chemistry had conferred upon mankind could not be too highly estimated, declared the Pharmaceutical Journal. James Marsh's Bodle-inspired discovery was the first major advance in modern chemical toxicology, and his test remained in use, with some modifications, for nearly 150 years.
Julian Rhine-Tutt was reading from The Inheritor's Powder by Sandra Hempel, abridged by Libby Spurrier. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4, and the producer was David Blount. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 20th of September. The general synopsis at 1800, low 4th, 1001, expected Germany 1013 by 1800 Friday. High 350 miles west of Trafalgar 1026, expected Fitzroy 1024 by same time. Atlantic low moving slowly east, expected 75 miles southwest of Iceland 987 by that time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, 40s, Cromarty, 4th. Variable 4 becoming southwesterly 4 or 5, occasionally 6 later in Cromarty. Showers, good. Tyne Dogger, west or northwest, backing south.